Welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federal Society's Religious Liberties Practice Group, was recorded on Tuesday, December 13, 2016, during a live teleform conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members.
Welcome to the Federal Society's teleform conference call. This afternoon, we will be discussing the future of religious liberties under the new administration. My name is Nate Kazmarek. I'm the Deputy Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Today, we welcome our experts, Professor Tom Berg from the University of St. Thomas Law School and Professor Rick Garnett from the University of Notre Dame Law School. Professor Berg will get us started with opening remarks. After opening remarks, we will go to the Q&A. Thank you for speaking with us, Tom. The floor is yours.
Well, thank you very much for having me, and thank you, everyone, for joining. Whoever won the election in November, some significant group of people in the nation was going to wake up the next morning worried about their prospects for practicing their faith and living consistently with its tenets. And although some of those fears were not totally unfounded. That's not where we should be in America, but that's where we are. The election of Donald Trump produces or puts off a set of threats primarily to the religious liberty of those who believe in traditional sexual morality, such as male-female marriage, and there are now opportunities to protect religious liberty in legitimate ways there. But in order for religious freedom to be credible and strong, it has to be religious liberty for all, including for Muslims, and the election of Trump poses a set of uncertain threats to Muslims' religious liberty. So I'll talk about these two areas then. And Rick will talk about some other areas, important areas. I'll talk about the protection of believers in traditional marriage and protection of Muslims. So first, traditionalists. So I'm going to mention some of the other areas of traditional sexual morality, abortion, contraception, but Rick will mostly talk about those. And I'll talk primarily about marriage. Of course, is how will a new administration change the situation in these areas, either by changing policies within executive power or by signing legislation that the previous administration wouldn't sign or by appointing judges. The Obama administration fought with objectors for years over its mandate to cover contraception. It refused to use federal conscience protections to block California's requirement that every insurance policy cover abortion. His executive order prohibiting sexual orientation discrimination by federal contractors contained no exception for religious organizations, which threatened harm to the work of entities like World Vision. And a Clinton administration would have continued and extended those policies. The Trump administration will probably reverse some of these, either totally or partially. I think we can expect the settlement of the contraception litigation on terms favorable to the objectors. On the issues concerning objections to same-sex marriage, traditionalist believers who object to same-sex marriage have been on the defensive, their claims of religious liberty increasingly dismissed as a cover for bigotry. So the new administration will likely be more sympathetic to those claims. Question is whether, how far will it go on that, whether will it entirely disregard the interests of same-sex couples in the balance. Some of us think it's possible and have argued in various forums that it's possible to protect both significantly. We'll have to see. Obama's executive order for federal contracts contained no exemption for religious organizations. Trump could modify the executive order to add such an exemption, which seems to me the cleanest thing to do. He might repeal the executive order altogether, which would be certainly a retreat from protection of gay rights, but he could simply put in the kind of religious exemption that Obama might have put in the first place. Trump might also wait for congressional legislation and sign it, protecting objectors who believe in traditional marriage. But there are real barriers there. The main legislative proposal is the First Amendment Defense Act, or FADA, which would protect organizations and individuals from suffering any federal penalty or disability, including loss of tax exemption, licensing, or funding, because on the basis that they act in accordance with the belief that marriage is only between one man and one woman. FATA addresses real problem situations. Organizations like World Vision would be really hampered in their work if they lost federal contracts. We may remember at the Obergefell oral argument that the Solicitor General could not give any assurance that there wouldn't be serious questions about whether traditionalist organizations believing in traditional marriage would, whether their tax-exempt status would be at issue. So FATA is addressing real issues, but it also has a couple of problems itself. First, in its present form, it's extremely broad. Unlike other religious freedom legislation modeled, for example, on the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, FATA gives absolute protection. There's no override for compelling interests. It protects, for example, the largest commercial business with no mechanism for giving consideration to the effects on same-sex couples. And that creates both legal and political difficulties. It gives the critics easy hypotheticals. If the owner of a closely held corporation the size of, say, Bechtel or Koch Industries decided not to hire gays, FATA would protect it, a business that contracted with the federal government. So given the previous firestorms in Indiana and elsewhere over religious freedom claims by commercial businesses, I imagine FATA will have no chance unless its scope is reduced. Even then, it'll draw intense opposition. It has essentially no Democratic support at this point. How will it overcome a filibuster? We'll have to see. There is some talk about putting together an alternative bill going under the slogan of fairness for all that would couple religious liberty protections with adding non-discrimination based on sexual orientation or gender identity to the categories, protected categories under the civil rights law. This is modeled after the similar combination in Utah, although here it's far more complicated. Now, I would support a properly narrowly tailored version of FATA. I'd also support this fairness for all concept. It does have a couple of advantages over FATA. It can be sold as a more even-handed protection of pluralism, not just a protection of one side. And it also could deal with state issues, because FATA only deals with federal impositions on religious liberty, and a lot of the threats come from state actions. We could talk more about that in the question and answer if you want. I think you could argue that some sort of protection for both sides is the more stable long-term solution. But protecting both sides faces even greater barriers than the barriers to the First Amendment Defense Act in this Congress. So it's uncertain what, if anything, will come out of Congress. Now let me talk about issues of freedom and equality for Muslims. Donald Trump has spoken in the past of banning Muslims from immigrating here, of creating a registry and database of Muslims, and of profiling Muslims and surveilling mosques. His language is loose, so we don't know what the exact proposals would be. But protecting Muslims from overreach or oppressive action is really vital, both in principle and for the long-term health of religious freedom. Disregarding religious freedom because of one state interest, even if it's national security, stands as a precedent for disregarding it because of others. Now, the dynamics here are uncertain. On the one hand, we have Trump's anti-Muslim rhetoric, and his attorney general nominee, Jeff Sessions, does not augur for really strong, vigorous civil rights protections. On the other hand, there are career lawyers in the Justice Department who enforce the statutes that protect against religious discrimination, and there are influential figures among social conservatives, such as Robbie George and others, who are really committed to Muslim freedom and equality, freedom for all. Let me just say a bit about some of the issues here, potential issues. First, on immigration, bans on who may enter the country or regulations of those who do enter or who have just entered. A ban on Muslims as such would certainly violate basic religious freedom principles. I say principles because it's not clear whether a court would strike it down. There is out there in immigration law the so-called plenary power doctrine, that Congress and in turn the president have plenary power to decide who can enter the country. A ban on Muslims entering, however, might be the best possible case to get the courts to say, well, this power is broad, but it's not unlimited. So we don't know exactly what the development in legal and constitutional doctrine might be there. More recently, of course, we've heard about a ban on people from certain nations, virtually all of them which would be Muslim majority nations. That's much more likely to be upheld in the courts. The plenary power doctrine would really cut in there. If you determine that certain nations were, as the Bush administration did, that certain nations were producing terrorists, it would be within the discretion of the government to decide that immigration should be restricted from those places. Now, the ACLU and others have talked about arguments that this would still be a gerrymander aimed at Muslims. All of the nations would be majority Muslims except for North Korea. I still think a ban even on these nations would be a questionable idea in terms of religious freedom, sending a negative message to the world. But in terms of constitutional doctrine, it would be more defensible, especially if it involves what vetting rather than a flat-out ban. And Trump, of course, has talked about extreme vetting. We don't know exactly what extreme vetting means. Vetting and some kind of registration for those who've just entered the country would be similar to the system that the Bush administration had in place until 2000, until it was ended by the suspended by Obama in 2011. The special registration system, NSEERS, and courts upheld that on the basis that it was not aimed at Muslims as such, but aimed at nations that were producing terrorists. Trump has also said we have to look at profiling Muslims and we have to check out the mosques. I quote him there. If he did that or tried to create a national database of Muslims, both would run into serious problems if they weren't based in some way on individualized suspicion, that is something other than simply one's religious identification. Database registration or registration of Muslims, if we're talking about U.S. citizens as opposed to immigrants, that would be far more likely to be struck down, I think, because it wouldn't involve the immigration power. There are other issues that Muslims face, issues around the country in opposition to the building of mosques in towns and cities, the use of zoning and other restrictions to prevent those. Muslim groups have been able to sue under the Religious Land Use and Institutionalized Persons Act, so-called RLUPRA. They can bring private suits, but they've also relied on Justice Department enforcement, which has been very strong in the past. Will that enforcement continue under a Trump administration with Attorney General Sessions? There are career employees who've been at Justice for a long time who are committed to that protection, to extending that to Muslims as well as to Christians and Jews. And one can hope that the career employees will continue with that enforcement. And then there's the whole issue of private violence against Muslims, which is on the rise. How much and how long this will last is open to question, but that's also a religious liberty issue. Will the Department of Justice, U.S. attorneys, the administration vigorously enforce the law to protect protect Muslims against private violence? So there are all these questions. There are tremendous benefits possibly in this administration now in avoiding some of the threats to religious freedom. But protection of religious freedom also has to be even-handed. And it does have to consider interests on the other side. The last thought that I'd leave is that this administration needs to watch out for hubris, as past administrations have had to do and sometimes failed to do. You have an impulse to get what you can while you're in charge, but that may work out to hurt you. The Democrats found that when they overreached, particularly on dismissing legitimate claims of religious freedom. The credibility of religious conservatives, I think, is at stake with this administration. They have to oppose it when it does wrong things. If they don't, that loss of credibility could have long-term effect on the credibility of religious freedom claims. I'll stop there.
Well, thanks. I agree and endorse all that my colleague said there. I'll try to add a few things and not repeat too much. I'm feeling a little bit sheepish, I admit, about sharing opinions about the, quote, future of religious liberties, unquote, since the recent election has confirmed the wisdom of the observation that it's really hard to make predictions, especially about the future. I was quite confident a few months ago about what the results of the election would be, and I was pretty confident also about what I thought the election of Secretary Clinton would mean for religious freedom, at least in some areas. I feel like looking forward now, I'm having to engage more in informed speculation, but I'll do the best I can. So one thing to start with, and I don't think Professor Berg touched on this, is just the reality that federal judges will be appointed going forward by a Republican administration rather than by a Democratic administration. That might seem fairly obvious, but President Obama enjoyed a fair bit of success in reshaping the federal courts. He had as many judges confirmed as President H.W. Bush did, and had Secretary Clinton been elected, there would have been a fairly dramatic transformation at least in the partisan composition of the federal courts. And the reality is that a lot of our religious freedom issues, for better or worse, get resolved in these federal courts. And while it's only a generalization, I think it's fair to say that judges appointed by Republican administrations tend to be more supportive of things like aid to religious schools programs or religious symbols in the public square. It's a mixed bag when it comes to exemptions, but certainly on the Supreme Court recently, I think it's fair to say that the Republican appointees have been a bit more friendly to at least some religious exemptions claims. In addition to the appointment and confirmation of judges, of course, there's a whole lot of other administrative and executive personnel who will be coming out of, you know, one partisan context rather than another. And many of these people will have as part of their portfolio religious freedom questions. And again, I think it's fair to say that that'll make a difference in how these issues are handled. Two of the most important Supreme Court cases in recent years having to do with religious freedom. The first is the Hobby Lobby case, which had to do with the Religious Freedom Restoration Act and its meaning for the contraception coverage mandate. And the second case is Hosanna Tabor, which had to do with the rights of religious institutions to choose and hire and to fire their own ministers. Each of those cases was important, and each of those cases left some questions unanswered. And I think going forward in the near term, we'll see other cases that will try to work out what these precedents mean. And circling back to what I said earlier, the fact that working out is going to be done by, at least it's likely to be done by a fair number of judges who were appointed by a Republican administration, that suggests which direction those things will go. So that's judges and personnel. A second area to talk about, and this complements some of what Professor Berg was saying having to do with religious exemptions for traditionalists in the marriage context. We've been controverting a fair bit in recent years about conscience protections in the healthcare context. This includes, of course, those employers who object to the contraception coverage mandate, but also there's been a lot of controversy about the extent to which religious pharmacists should be required to provide pharmaceuticals that they regard as abortifacients, perhaps. There's been controversy about the extent to which religious hospitals should have to provide referrals for abortions or even to perform abortions or sterilizations. Looking down the pike, it was easy to see that increasingly there's going to be controversy about the extent to which healthcare professionals can be required to participate in doctor-assisted suicide or euthanasia. In all of these areas, there are, and these are challenging areas, but there are lines that separate people who tend to be more supportive of exemptions for religious objectors, who tend to be more solicitous of the religious autonomy of healthcare providers and healthcare institutions, and then those, on the other hand, who tend to prioritize the government mandates. My hope going forward, and I think the what we've heard about the nominations, especially in the Department of Health and Human Services, provides some basis for this hope, is that the incoming administration will be friendly to conscience protections in the healthcare context, and that it will not use either regulations or conditions attached to federal spending to try to push religious objectors into participating in healthcare practices that they regard as immoral. A third context, which might seem a bit far removed from religious freedom, but I think isn't far removed at all, is education. The new administration, it appears, is going to be supportive of choice-based education reform, including school choice programs that allow low-income kids to get some assistance attending religious schools. The Obama administration had actually been quite supportive of a number of charter school reforms, and I think that was to its credit. But in several states, the administration attempted to interfere with and, in my view, to undermine school choice programs, including in Wisconsin and in Louisiana. My hope is that the new administration will not only not interfere with state school choice programs, but will do what it can to support them. Obviously, education is primarily a state-level issue, but at the federal, the tone can be set at the federal level. One case having to do with school choice is the Trinity Lutheran case coming out of the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals. That case has not yet been set for oral argument, I suspect in part because of uncertainty both about the election and about the Ninth Justice, assuming one ever arrives on the scene. The Trinity Lutheran case presents an opportunity for the Supreme Court to make a very important ruling that states are not allowed to use state constitutional provisions as a justification for discriminating against religious schools in the context of neutral aid programs. The precise issue in Trinity Lutheran has to do with whether or not a daycare center that's run by a Lutheran church should be allowed to receive recycled tire waste in order to help make its playground more safe. But the issue actually has much broader implications for school choice programs. A fourth point that's worth mentioning does connect with what Professor Berg said, but I think it's worth underscoring. Professor Berg mentioned the FADA, the First Amendment Defense Act, and also the efforts to enact at the federal level a kind of Utah compromise for dealing with objectors on the marriage issue. But I think we can actually step back from the marriage issue itself, or from all the sort of gay rights issues, and say that as a general matter, we were seeing a move in the Obama administration toward using federal funding, federal contracts, and federal non-discrimination law, all in ways to push against or put pressure on traditionalist religious institutions. So just to take an example, imagine, you don't have to imagine because it's a real case, but an entity like Catholic Charities that provides a great deal of important services in the areas of fighting human trafficking or resettling refugees, if the rule is that in order to participate, to cooperate with the government to receive federal funds in resettling refugees or fighting trafficking, if the rule is that you then have to waive or give up your right to choose your own employees on the basis of religious commitments, that's going to be a real loss if these entities are no longer able to participate with the federal government. In all kinds of contexts, if the ability of a religious entity to do its services, to provide to provide its services, to serve those it wants to serve, if its ability to do that is conditioned, whether through licensing or funding or accreditation or what have you, on adopting non-discrimination rules that conflict with religious commitments, we're going to see a real weakening of our ability to solve certain really important problems. So I'd encourage all of us looking forward to sort of watch to see if the new administration rolls back some of these conditions that the Obama administration had put in place, and, as Professor Berg said, whether there are any steps that can be taken to provide protections from losing things like tax exemption or accreditation or licensing to traditional institutions. Professor Berg pointed out that the First Amendment Defense Act is in some ways broader than the Religious Freedom Restoration Act because it doesn't involve balancing, and I agree with him that that makes the act politically a tough sell. I would just say that in my own view that broader reach might be justified, though, because again we're not talking so much about regulations as we are talking about conditions. And then a final point is just to talk about, and again, this is a very high level of generality, about religious freedom in the political arena. I do more of my work on religious freedom issues in the court of law, but the court of public opinion is probably the most important arena here. And going forward, and again, echoing some things that Tom said, I think it's important for defenders of religious freedom to appreciate the fact that in the political arena, there are some challenges. The first is the branding problem that religious freedom has if it's associated exclusively with culture war issues or with sexual revolution issues. Again, the HHS litigation and the furor over the Indiana Religious Freedom Restoration Act contributed to that. But it's important to remember that the vast majority of religious freedom cases don't involve hot-button culture war issues. The vast majority involve burdens on vulnerable religious minorities. A second challenge in the political arena, I think, is the so-called rise of the nones. That's N-O-N-E-S, by which social scientists mean people who profess to have no religious affiliation. One thing to keep our eye on is the possibility that as more and more people report that they don't identify with any religious tradition, the danger is that they come to see religious freedom as kind of a luxury good for a few rather than a fundamental human right that belongs to all. And as Professor Berg pointed out in his discussion of the religious freedom rights of Muslims, it's crucial for the credibility of the religious freedom cause that those who defend it always insist on the importance of religious freedom for all and not just for a few. So those are the concerns I see at play in the political arena. I mentioned a few issues where I think religious freedom will be hashed out legally and in the policy context. And with that, I'll stop and I guess give it back to our moderator.
Okay, very good. Professor Berg, do you have any questions of Professor Garnett or vice versa before we go to audience questions?
No, I don't really have any questions. Just a couple of comments. This is really just following up on things that Rick said. Yeah, I mean, he raises the pharmacist issue. That's an example of a case that, you know, for the most part, is going to be decided at the state level. The case before the Supreme Court came out of Washington. It's state regulation. So what does an administration, federal administration, have to do with that? Well, that's a case in which a fifth vote on the Supreme Court might really have mattered. The court might have taken granted certiorari in the case coming out of Washington, which was called Stormans, if Justice Scalia hadn't died. That's a fairly dramatic example of the effect of court personnel on these issues. I can say that the Trinity Lutheran case also is an example of that. I filed a brief. I supervised students writing briefs in religious liberty cases in a kind of a clinic setting, and we filed a brief in that case. This is the one about the playground, and we had draft without revealing any work product secrets. We had drafted one version of the brief, or at least an outline. And after Justice Scalia died, we were still working. The brief hadn't been filed yet. We had to really scrap that and write something that we thought would be more directed at a different justice. There were new swing justices as a result of the change in the composition of the court, and we had to write what was in fact a much narrower brief. So if that case is it ultimately goes forward, the Ninth Justice, if there is one, would have a real effect on the results. So that's my only comments for now. Look forward to hearing questions.
Okay, very good. Let's do that now. In a moment, you'll hear a prompt indicating that the floor mode has been turned on. After that, to request the floor, please enter star, then the pound sign on your telephone. When we get to your request, you will hear a prompt, and then you may ask your question. We will answer questions in the order in which they are received. Again, to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound sign on your telephone keypad. Let's go to the first question of the afternoon.
Hi, this is Will Trackman from Douglas County School District. We actually have a voucher program that is waiting on Trinity Lutheran. And I heard the speaker just say, if that case goes forward, I was curious what the latest was. I know that the AG-elect of Missouri has talked about maybe just taking that case out because the victory of the Eighth Circuit was in favor of religious freedom. And then if that case does proceed, how that affects a neutral voucher program that then would offer vouchers to religious programs at the choice of the parents.
Tom, you want to take that since you were doing the brief?
Well, the Eighth Circuit went the other way. The Eighth Circuit ruled for the state. And so, you know, if you leave that opinion standing, that wouldn't be an advantage to the church's claim. And Josh Hawley, who was elected Attorney General in Missouri, I suspect, based on his having worked with the Beckett Fund in the past and other things, that he's more sympathetic to the church's claim to equal treatment in the funding program. So whether he wants to, go forward with that case and hope for a good result in the Supreme Court, or try to settle it, and what discretion he has to settle it, I don't know. I haven't really followed all of those things, but I suspect that as with the new administration in Washington, there will be a new attitude toward that case in Missouri.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, Attorney General-elect Hawley, I'm confident, is sympathetic to the position of the church, and also just to the more generally to the position that things like state law Blaine amendments, so-called, shouldn't get in the way of equal treatment for religious institutions in the context of neutral programs. I could imagine a world where the new Attorney General in Missouri changes policy with respect to how to administer this program. I don't know enough about Missouri law to know whether he would have the ability to do that under state law. But if he could, I suppose there's a chance that would just moot out the case so far as Missouri is concerned. And then I guess that would leave hanging the issue of the Douglas County case, which, as the caller pointed out, was being kind of held for this Trinity Lutheran case.
Yeah, I don't know Missouri law. It's hard to see exactly how the Attorney General could change the rule that was adopted by the whatever the Department of Natural Resources is in Missouri, but
yeah, right.
maybe there's some way to do it.
Okay, very good. Professors, we have one question, one person waiting to ask a question in our queue. If others would like to join the queue, please enter star, then the pound sign on your keypad. Before we go to that next question, just one programming announcement. Our next teleform will be tomorrow afternoon at 2 p.m. That call will recap the Supreme Court's recent decision in the insider trading case Salmon v. the United States. Todd Bronstein, who is the global head of legal investigations at Willis Towers and Watson, will be our speaker for that call. Okay, let's go to our next question.
Thank you for a very illuminating discussion of these issues. I think this question is for Professor Burt. I certainly agree that treating Muslims as a category of identification in any negative way would be overly broad and offensive to religious freedom. But suppose the focus at the time of immigration is a narrower one and focused on whether the person has a commitment to those elements of Sharia law which might advocate violence and certainly would place women in an inferior legal status. Do you think it's appropriate to ask questions about whether applicants for immigrant status are committed to those elements of Sharia law?
We ask people about their, you know, intent to overthrow the government of the United States or questions like that. I don't see why you can't ask that same question with people coming in from Muslim countries or people of any faith. We don't ask people whether they're committed to the equality of women, I don't think. And so I'm not sure that you should ask that question just of people of one faith. But certainly there's a national security issue. It just should be much more tailored to the national security questions. And I think that traditional Muslim approach to the treatment of women is bad in many ways, that's not a factor, I think, that we've considered in immigration in the past. And so I don't think that we could do it just for Muslims. But you know, there's certainly a good deal of power at the border, and there's a good deal of power in treating people who have just come into the country on a tourist visa or a work visa or some other kind of immigration status. And there are lots of ways to get at the real issues here without the kind of broad focus on Islam and on every aspect of Islam that we might disagree with. Right? It's a national security issue, and it ought to be focused on that.
Okay, thank you, Professor Berg. We will move to our next caller.
You mentioned the abortion contraceptive case. I'm just wondering, has there been any movement anywhere in the country on the Supreme Court's remand of Little Sisters and related cases?
So the Little Sisters case, which the Supreme Court, I guess, calls Zubik, as the caller knows, and maybe a lot of the listeners do too, the Justice Scalia died after the case was taken, and so the court appears to have found a way to kind of make the case go away rather than to actually deal with the objections of the Little Sisters. My understanding, and Professor Berg can correct me if I'm wrong, is that what the Supreme Court told the parties to do, that is to work out an arrangement that is satisfactory to the objectors, has not yet happened. But it's also my understanding that at least some of the objectors are not currently being legally required to provide the service they object to. So my sense is that we're in limbo. And again, my prediction is that given who the nominee for the HHS secretary is, that there's a pretty good chance that putting aside the whole question of the ultimate future of the Affordable Care Act, but it strikes me as a pretty good chance that the requirements that these objectors are complaining about will go away because the exemption will be either because the exemption will be broadened or because the mandate itself will go away. But to circle back to the actual question, so far as I know, the court made the Zubik litigation go away, and it's been in a holding pattern ever since.
Yeah, I'm not aware of what's happened in the lower courts or any actually, talks about what the settlement would have been. There were real barriers to between the two parties, distance between the two parties' positions that in some ways seemed pretty nuanced differences, but they were still very, very real under the Obama administration. Now that's going to very likely to change. I read Vice President Pence saying this issue was going to resolve this issue, and they were going to resolve it in a way that erred on the side of religious freedom. And that, together with the nomination for HHS, I think is a signal. They could repeal the mandate altogether. I don't know whether that would be might be politically unpopular to repeal the mandate altogether. I don't know about that. Maybe Rick has a different sense about that. They could certainly expand the exemption and give a total exemption to the religious nonprofits who have been challenging the arrangement that's in place. Or they could kind of take the government could sort of go along with the position that the nonprofits have been asserting in the court, which is that they would not object to having insurance for contraception be provided by the same insurance company that provides the policy for other health matters, but just have it be an entirely different policy with different enrollment, different insurance card, and not just a springboard from the original policy. That's what the plaintiffs in the Supreme Court said, that they would be able to live with that. And so, the narrowest thing that the government could do is just say, we'll go along with that.
Yeah, it is worth remembering, just to follow up on this. I mean, that although this debate sort of really sucked up all the oxygen for many years now, we're talking about a relatively small number of employers who are objecting, a number of states have coverage mandates of their own. So it's not entirely clear that it would change the coverage that many people are receiving if the new administration were to, say, just expand the exemption to include entities like the Little Sister of the Poor, and then perhaps to find, if it wanted to use other rules or perhaps new legislation to provide other avenues for women to get this coverage with no cost sharing. But I tend to think that compromise here is actually more doable than a lot of the debate has made it sound, but that I could be excessively optimistic.
Okay, if you would like to ask a question, please enter star then the pound sign on your telephone keypad to get in the queue. Let's go to our next question.
My question relates to international religious freedom with the new administration. With the administration's heavy focus on the business interests of the United States, I'm wondering whether either of you have a sense of how that bodes for people of faith around the world who are experiencing persecution from the Middle East to Russia to China, Africa, Cuba. You name it, and in particular, a new Secretary of State nominee, Tillerson. If you have any insights as to what we might expect from Trump generally, or future Secretary Tillerson in particular, and their commitment to international religious freedom.
Well, I can't speak to the nominee's views. I just don't know. I appreciate the caller raising the issue of international religious freedom, though, because I had meant to say and I forgot. It's always worth remembering when we have these conversations about this issue that even though religious freedom has faced and does face real challenges here in the States, and I wouldn't minimize those for a second. As we're reminded, religious freedom is under real severe and often lethal pressure in many parts of the world, where as I joke with some, so I guess I shouldn't be even joking about it, but as I talk with some of my students, you know, there are people living in a lot of countries where, you know, they would love to have the opportunity to argue about whether or not we're going to have creches in public buildings, or whether, you know, we're going to have the Ten Commandments posted on the wall of a school. What they're arguing about, obviously, is whether they're going to be allowed to convert, or whether they're going to be allowed to build a place of worship, or whether they're going to be allowed to pick their own bishops. So there are real challenges. In my view, it's a mixed bag in terms of U.S. policy. I think the Department of State and other entities have at times done good things on this front and, you know, shown a light on countries and contexts where religious freedom is really being attacked. But then at other times, I've been worried that the administration's been, a little too hands-off and perhaps been willing to treat religious freedom as, you know, merely freedom of worship rather than actual freedom to practice. And it's maybe a natural tendency of diplomats to undervalue the importance of religious freedom, which, after all, religious freedom can be disruptive, and to overvalue stability. So that's going to be a balance going forward. I didn't hear anything in the campaign to make me think that the president-elect has given a lot of thought to this particular issue. Tom, I don't know if you have anything to add to that.
Not much. I think Rick's points are great about the seriousness of the issues abroad. It's also the international issues don't have the kind of immediate payoff in terms of votes that, you know, protecting the freedom of social conservatives here does, or protecting even the freedom of Muslims to the extent that that's a cause that liberals have really taken up, or, you know, whatever. It's just not as the effects here are not as direct. People can't see how it's going to affect their lives as much. So it's a real test of a commitment to the principle of religious freedom. And I kind of agree that we don't really know what Trump's attitude is towards that, or more importantly, the people in the administration who will staff it. But it's certainly crucial in principle, and in a more indirect way, it's crucial in practice. You know, there's a lot of really good work coming out now on the importance of religious freedom to the flourishing of a society, to the economic flourishing of a society, to the political flourishing. Brian Grimm, I forget the name of his institute exactly, or his project exactly, but it's on religion and economic freedom and economic advancement. And he's working with the Berkeley Center at Georgetown, which has done a lot of great work on making the connection between religious freedom and the advancement of a society in various ways: equality of women, political freedom, economic advancement. And those societies are also safer, and they're less. They tend to be less of a threat to world order. So it's in the long term interest of the United States. That's certainly the basis of our international religious freedom policy. And so hopefully, even an administration that's focused on business interests will take that seriously. It depends a lot on who's in the right. In the right places, right? Rick and I have talked about this from time to time. Personnel is everything, yeah. And until we know more about who's going to be in there, it's just hard to say.
You know, one more thing that might be worth adding is just that is to recall that the current administration has been pretty energetic in trying to export its views regarding particularly abortion rights, but also some other kind of some other issues where there's tension between, you know, one understanding of anti-discrimination law on the one hand and traditional religious beliefs on the other. Again, there's been efforts to sort of use the international public law and international human rights law apparatuses to kind of impose this or to attach conditions to aid and so on. And I think that's often been resented as a kind of ideological colonialism by some other countries. And so one thing I'll be looking for is whether that's dialed back in the incoming administration.
Okay, thank you, Professor Garnett. We have one question waiting in the queue. If you would like to join the queue to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound sign on your telephone keypad. A reminder to keep an eye out for emails announcing upcoming teleforum calls. You can also consult the full schedule of our teleforum calls on the Federal Society's website, fedsoc.org. Also available there are podcasts of our previously recorded teleforum calls that you might have missed. Let's go to the next question.
Hi, this is Daniel Chen from St. Louis, and my question is also regarding the Little Sisters in Zuba case on remand. I was wondering for the speakers, beyond what you think may happen, strategically speaking, do you think that the HHS secretary should revise the mandate or should the challenger settle the case, or whether they should continue to litigate the case back up to the Supreme Court? And the reason why I ask this is I wonder if religious liberty might be on better footing if the HHS doesn't expand the exemption or the challengers don't settle. And it's because I think that there's some old religious liberty cases like Bowen versus Roy and Ling that are still contested and up for grabs, and a favorable decision in the Little Sisters case might help us interpret these precedents in a way that provide more protection for religious liberty claimants.
So that's a sophisticated question. My instinct, for what it's worth, is to hope that the matter of the contraception coverage mandate is actually settled, or that it goes away because the rule goes away. And I'd prefer that to having the case go back up to the Supreme Court. And for me, that's because I think it would be better for religious freedom generally if the vehicles for, you know, judges addressing it weren't tied up with, again, issues connected to the sexual revolution. I think that has a distorting effect. Now, you mentioned, you're right to mention cases like Bowen and Ling, but although remember, those are free exercise cases and not cases having to do with the interpretation of RFRA. And my sense is that the majority opinion in the Hobby Lobby case actually gives a fairly robust interpretation of RFRA. And if that interpretation is followed by courts in whether in, you know, the context of contraception coverage mandates specifically or just more generally, that could provide again, pretty robust religious freedom protections. But just in terms of the optics and the messaging and all these kinds of things, the framing of the matter, I'd rather see religious freedom fights about other issues for at least for a time than the contraception coverage mandate.
Professor Garnett, we've actually lost the connection to Professor Berg.
Okay.
So we're trying to get him back on the line, but you will have to field this next question on your own.
I'll do my best.
I'd like to follow up on the question about Sharia law. And my question is really is, it seems to me that, or I guess I'm asking if you can get to that question by not asking specifically about women, but whether or not the person recognizes that all men are created equal and endowed by their creator with certain inalienable rights.
Well, unfortunately, this was one of the issues that Professor Berg was addressing, but I'll try to pull out what I think was implicit in some of the things he was saying. So the first thing to remember is that the government's authority when it comes to who's admitted at our border is very broad. For better or worse, the government's able to deal with folks who are seeking entry to our country in ways that it might not be able to deal with those of us who are already here legally or who are citizens. I think Professor Berg said, though, and I think he's right, that if we take the principles underlying our legal religious freedom regime, we should be skeptical of any screening devices that focus particularly and in kind of a blunt way on people simply because of their professed religion. Now, the caller suggests, well, so could instead you have questions that have to do with, you know, a general commitment to equality or a general commitment to the rule of law. And so I guess my inclination is to say questions like that that are asked to everybody are much, and assuming that the questions actually have a relation to some, you know, real concern we might have, like national security and so on, I think that's a better way to go than to operate on the basis of certain presumptions, which might not be accurate about what Muslims believe, about what the content of so-called Sharia law actually is, and so on. It just seems safer and more consistent with our commitments to think, okay, what are the concerns we have about people coming into our country, and let's make sure we act on those concerns in every case in ways that don't, again, rely on stereotypes or that target particular religious traditions. And if when Professor Berg gets back on the call, he can tell me if he thinks I'm wrong about that, but that's my reaction.
Okay, I'd like to ask one other question if I can, and that's what's the prospect of Smith being changed, Smith versus Employment Commission?
Yeah, so Employment Division versus Smith, a decision from the early 90s, which many people regard as having been bad for religious liberty. The court in that case said that religious believers aren't constitutionally entitled to exemptions from general laws. The Religious Freedom Restoration Act, of course, was a response to that, and so that act provides a protection that's much more robust than the protection that's provided by Smith. But since Smith is still the governing law in the states, obviously it matters. The shortest answer is I don't know. Personnel has changed a fair bit on the court since Smith. We've lost people who are in the majority, and so it's always possible that their replacements could have a different view. It's possible, for example, that Justice Alito or Justice Kagan or Justice Sotomayor would have a different view about that rule. The issue hasn't really been squarely presented, in part because I think the RFRA has made it possible for it not to be presented. I guess my own view, if I had to engage in informed speculation, is that it won't likely be overturned at the Supreme Court. And so I would expect to see a continuation of these efforts in the states to enact laws that are like the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, but on the state level. And that's a way of kind of filling in the gaps that are left by the Smith decision. The problem is the Religious Freedom Restoration Act issue, the exemptions issue, has become radioactive in many states because, as we've seen in Georgia, Indiana, Arizona, North Carolina, it's become associated with fights about the transgender issue and bathroom access and things like that, even though, as I said before, the vast number of religious exemptions cases have nothing to do with those issues. So my prediction is that we'll continue to see the exemptions issue fought out primarily in terms of exemption statutes in the states, and I think it's less likely that you'll see the Supreme Court undoing the Smith rule and constitutionalizing strict scrutiny.
Hello? Hello?
Hey, Tom, welcome back.
Hey, all right. What Rick said about Smith is I basically agree with, although I think there's some possibility that if the court got a case from a state that did not have one of these religious freedom statutes that protected religious exercise broadly, and it was not a federal law so that the federal RFRA did not apply, they might feel a need in the right case to step in and create a standard that gives more protection to free exercise than the Smith case did. Justice Alito, I think, from what I know about him as a lower court judge and on the Supreme Court, has that kind of inclination. I suspect even some of the liberals on the court do, although their commitment to free exercise runs out when it begins to run up against anti-discrimination law. So I wouldn't see an anti-discrimination case pitted against religious freedom. I wouldn't see that as the kind of case that would be likely to provoke this kind of re-examination of Smith. It would be instead a case protecting a more classic religious minority like Sikhs or Muslims or Hindus or even some group like that.
Okay, Professor Berg, I'm glad we got you back on. We do not have any more questions in the queue, and I think maybe it's a good time now. Gentlemen, if you'd like to offer any additional comments or concluding remarks, we'd love to have them.
Well, I guess for my part, I don't want to repeat things that have already been said, but I would just say I think that the recent election means that things will be different than they otherwise would have when it comes to religious freedom. And in my view, those differences are going to will primarily be good for religious freedom. But I think those of us who have that view should also keep in mind the important points that Professor Berg made about religious freedom being a human right that belongs to all. And so it would be a mistake to be complacent or indifferent if the people whose religious freedom came under fire were Muslims who were being targeted for discriminatory treatment.
I think there are a lot of good things that could be done by this administration to protect religious liberty, and in many ways important rights are going to be safer than they would have been under a Clinton administration. But let me come back just quickly to this point about hubris. This was a close election. There were more votes for Clinton than for Trump. The demographics continue to work against the traditional positions on same-sex marriage. This is a long-term question, and I do think that folks on the social conservative side have to really be mindful of not overreaching and of trying to get things put in place that are sustainable. And to me, that involves both recognizing the interests on the other side of even the marriage questions. There are ways to protect both rights, and I think over the long run that'll be more sustainable than reaching for the broadest possible protections that you could slip through in one legislative vote. And second, taking into account making sure that you're protecting the rights of all faiths, particularly Muslims. So, this moment too shall pass, and it's a important moment to protect one group of religious freedom claims, but it can't be left at that.
Okay, well, Professor Berg, you had the last word, but gentlemen, I think it's been a great discussion, and on behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank you for joining us today. We welcome listener feedback by email at info@fedsoc.org. Thank you all for joining us. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.